It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning December 8th, 2023. And for a week or two more, I am still in Ireland. Media concern across many nations is rife now about all our futures once artificial intelligence fully gets integrated into our digital lives. Now that the dust has finally settled over the troubled leadership of OpenAI, the leading or at least most attention-getting company that has brought breakthroughs in the use of AI, I would like to offer one sidelight on it that hasn't been greatly noted in the mainstream press. It has been noted, of course, in some at least, of the technology universe's own information outlets. What we all saw was a fight for the soul of AI, if I can use that oxymoron, or more simply and precisely, a fight for control over the OpenAI company. The fight saw its former board firing the WizKid CEO, Sam Altman, then, in a fast succession of greatly ballyhooed events, the staff rebelled and won the board's resignation, and soon Altman's return as well, holding office alongside a whole new board. My hometown newspaper, The New York Times, was uncharacteristically dialectical and blunt when it summarized the meaning of all this. The Times headline ran, "AI belongs to the capitalists now." The point being, in this widely shared mainstream interpretation, that there were two schools of thought at loggerheads here. One, that AI must be carefully controlled in its development for fear of possibly disastrous consequences to humanity, as paranoid as that may sound, while the other school believes that AI is a world-changing innovation like the steam engine, electricity, or the personal computer that will usher in a whole new era of prosperity. It will make, and here I will directly quote the Times technology columnist Kevin Roos, when he used more language untypical of the Times, it will make, he wrote, gobs of money for the businesses that harness AI's potential. It may or may not be true that the gobs of money side won this fight, but something else is very clear and pointed out very fully by Wired, one of those leading insider publications of the tech world. Wired quotes Margaret O'Mara, a history professor at the University of Washington and author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. She referred to the changes at OpenAI as a classic piece of, quote, back to business, meaning a return to the big tech boys club way of doing business. For the unavoidable fact is that there are now no women in the leadership of OpenAI. Indeed, and I find this choice well nigh inexplicable, one import into the board, from the wider, more traditional world, if you like, is none other than the former U.S. Treasury Secretary and one-time president of Harvard University, Larry Summers. You'll remember, I trust, how Summers got himself into deep trouble by claiming that innate differences between the sexes may explain why fewer women succeed in science and technology. Choice remarks that, of course, he soon had to apologize for. There have been some suggestions that the company now wants to find women to serve on the board, but that won't be easy. Perhaps understandably, to quote Wired magazine again, prominent women in tech say they don't want to join OpenAI's all-male board. It's worth raising the experience of one woman who previously served on the board. I'm thinking of Helen Toner, who has concentrated on AI safety in her work for the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown University. As a board member, she found herself incurring CEO Altman's wrath for, in his view, criticizing the company in an academic paper for being less committed to safety than other app developers. That argument between man and woman was one of the catalysts for the company's internal split. Wired canvassed the opinions of other female luminaries of AI about any of them possibly stepping into Toner's and other former board members' shoes. No enthusiasm greeted its inquiries. I should quote what was said by Timnit Gebru, the ex-Google executive who founded the Institute for Distributed Artificial Intelligence Research, which encourages diversity in this machine learning field. She said, "Such a female person on OpenAI's board would have a horrible time because they would constantly be fighting an uphill battle." Such battling has had its counterpart in another intelligence field that has perhaps been more immediately drastic and consequential. I mean in the work of Israeli intelligence, and in particular, the extraordinary intelligence failure exposed by Hamas's horrifically effective invasion, its killings and hostage seizing. Israel's previously much vaunted military intelligence, the external spy agency Mossad, and the internal service Shin Bet have all come under strong critical scrutiny in the media and elsewhere. One striking angle has been explored by two journalists who have always been especially incisive in this realm of Israel's security. One is Yossi Melman, an Israeli specialist with the Haaretz news organization, with whom I once worked to expose some underreported military collaboration between Israel and South Africa back in the apartheid days. And the other is a former CBS Jerusalem correspondent, Dan Raviv. Together, they make a very effective probing pair. In an article for Airmail, the online publication that Graydon Carter founded after he left editing Vanity Fair magazine, the two reporters do not pull any punches. Their story headline is, "How Misogyny Played into the Israeli Defense Forces' Failure to Stop the October 7th Attack." They point out how much of the Gaza borderline was surveilled by automatic means under remote control, and that the human intel part of the system was in large part young and female. The diligent border observers were almost all female soldiers aged 18 to 21. Other journalists have poured through intelligence briefings, some from as much as a year before the attacks, which revealed that evidence of Hamas's intentions was fully available but ignored, or it was interpreted by the mostly male analysts as merely aspirational. Hubris among those analysts may also have led them to dismiss Hamas as not having the capacity to actually carry out their ambitious plans. Melman and Raviv's work shows that as the attacks grew near, just about 3 months before them, in fact, one of the very few senior female analysts was alarmed by video evidence of Hamas in training, performing in rehearsal exactly the cross-border incursions they did eventually carry out. And she sounded a warning. But she was told by male superiors that she was a hysterical woman who didn't understand what they knew. "Your role is to use your eyes, not your brains," she said a commander told her. "Women are not good at analyzing." Among many women the two journalists interviewed, a sergeant in charge of some border spotters, Vicky Secker, who can be named since she is no longer in the force, had similar experiences of being told she was foreseeing imaginary scenarios and exaggerating the possibilities and the dangers. She now says the day's overall failure was a direct result of, quote, complacency and contempt by her military superiors. We should not forget how much the women paid for the men's arrogant mistakes. 15 of the female spotters were killed as Hamas swarmed into their bases after knocking out cameras and sensors on the border. According to Israeli forensic investigators, some of these soldiers, it has not been made public how many, were raped before being shot, just as happened evidently to many civilian women too. Here in Ireland, there has been some attempt to shift the logjam that has paralysed the government in Northern Ireland, those six counties out of the whole island's 32, which are still under British ownership and were the site for 30 years of urban warfare until the Good Friday Peace Agreement of 1998. And what changes there have been in that time of peace, sometimes uneasy peace, as it has to be said. Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, is now led by women, Mayor Lou MacDonald in Ireland as a whole, and Michelle O'Neill in the North. And as the media beat has noted several times recently, in polls covering both South and North, Sinn Féin is ahead of every other party. Ms. O'Neill came first in actual governmental elections for the Northern Province, and under the Good Friday Agreement, she is therefore entitled to become First Minister, the local equivalent to Prime Minister. But, and there always seems to be a but in Northern Irish politics, the Democratic Unionists, the most stubborn of the parties who want to continue the union with Britain, have refused, for over 18 months now, to operate the elected assembly or to take part in the power-sharing executive that the Good Friday Agreement set up. Their reason for the boycott is disappointment with what Boris Johnson's Brexit deal left them. Remember him? The British public can't forget him, with the ex-premier having to appear for two successive days this week before a public inquiry into his administration's handling or mishandling of the COVID pandemic, including, inevitably, all that notorious partying inside No. 10 Downing Street while he was in charge. In the matter of trade, especially exports and imports, Johnson's negotiated Brexit arrangements left Northern Ireland in a somewhat anomalous position, officially still part of the UK, but also partly separate from it. And various tweaks to the overall agreement over time, with names like the Northern Ireland Protocol and the Windsor Framework, have not satisfied the angry unionists, not enough to get them back into helping to run an effective government. Now a committee of the UK Parliament, one with oversight responsibility for the province, is suggesting some changes, occasionally quite radical, to get things moving again. There's not a lot of optimism in Irish media that the stalemate can be loosened. One rather obvious point stays in the forefront, that the Good Friday Agreement, as it stands, would call, given the current electoral lie of the land, for the Democratic Unionists' leader, a red-blooded Ulsterman, Geoffrey Donaldson, to take a position in the power-sharing executive that carries the title Deputy First Minister, that is, deputy to Ms. O'Neill. One only softly whispered consideration may lie behind one of the parliamentary committee's suggestions, that the number two position could be renamed. Both positions would then be called in future Joint First Minister. That couldn't be, could it, an attempt to give a little boost to a man otherwise reluctant to take a secondary position to a woman? That's all from the Media Beat this week from Ireland. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.